The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Anna Bodkin. She joins us on the telephone in New York City. Welcome back, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me, Vic.
And welcome back to the States. How long have you been back?
Oh, I've been back for a couple of years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I'm trying to remember. The last time I had you on the program was for your book that was called Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. And at that time, you talked about this project, which has now become a book called Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. Tell our listeners how you got the idea for doing this particular book.
All my work is about other ways of looking at the world, and also all my work is an attempt to bring the world to some kind of accountability. So I was working with a family of nomadic Fulani cowboys in the Sahel in Mali because I wanted to explore what it's like to perceive the world at the speed of 3 miles an hour moving through open ground, which is how we evolved to move. And while I was working with the nomads, you know, we would pass rivers, and I saw people poling their way across rivers on these beautiful boats, and I thought, so much of my work also is about boundaries. And, you know, I grew up in the Soviet Union, so I grew up behind the Iron Curtain, and I was a war correspondent for 15 years, and boundaries and borders, physical and geographical and political and emotional borders, are very much what shapes me and I think what shapes us. And so I thought, what would it be like to work with people who have always straddled the utmost border, at least what I at the time thought was the utmost border, the border between the solid, the terra firma, and the unfathomable, the ocean, right? So, and of course, before we walked out of the, climbed down the trees and started walking upright and walked out into open ground at 3 miles an hour, we were born in the sea. We came out of the sea 60 million years ago. So it's another level of homecoming, in a way, to work at sea for me. So I went to work in Joal, which is the largest artisanal fishing port in Senegal, west coast of Africa, to work with people who are straddling the border between the land and the sea, and also between climate change and food and having and not having, and that's the origin of Fisherman's Blues.
You just mentioned how you thought this boundary between terra firma and the unfathomable was the most impressive one that you could think of at the time. Have you changed your mind? Is it now outer space?
No, but I have discovered that it's not as set a boundary as I had expected it to be for my convenience. Mm-hmm. So I thought that it was clear-cut, but it's not. And one of the many reasons it is not a clear-cut boundary is, of course, that the ocean is changing rapidly because of climate change, because of the sea level is changing, the salinity of the sea is changing. But also, it's such a permeable membrane, the sea, the ocean, and the rack line between the sea and the land. And it's very hard to actually draw that line and as a solid or as a tangible line, which I think is maybe the most beautiful disappointment as a researcher that I've encountered. You know, here's another boundary I'd hoped for that is ineffable.
Mm. Anna Bodkin joins us. Her book is Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. In that previous book, when you were with the Fulani nomads, as readers, we discovered that this world that they have lived in for millennia has changed rapidly, and the things that they are accustomed to experiencing are changing rapidly, and their lifestyles are threatened. And you found very much the same thing with these fishers, didn't you?
I think that the world is one, right? We all share it. It's just how long we can choose to pretend that we're not noticing the changes. You know, in the West, many people, not everybody, but many people have the privilege of having shelter that is protected, air-conditioned, having a distance between us and the land that we can pretend that we're not noticing the changes. It's much harder in the Global South, where people live much more closely connected to natural resources. And yes, of course, fishermen who live off the sea are noticing every minute change in the sea, much of which is caused by climate change, but also by overfishing, not so much by artisanal fishermen, but as a by the mechanized industry that is literally vacuuming the sea empty of fish. And both of these events, both climate change and decimation of marine resources, are performed, if you will, in the name of our avarice here in the global north, the avarice of people who choose not to pay attention to our planet.
Mm. Avarice, yes. I agree with you, Anna. The book is Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. In this community, the men, most of the men, fish. The women do not. Tell our listeners how you, a white woman, was able to fish. How you were able to become a part of this, to look at it, to watch it, to examine it.
You know, Vic, you know, I've been doing this for 22 years. For 22 years, I've been insinuating myself in other people's lives and kitchens and homes and tents and boats, and I still don't have an answer to that question. I don't know why we let strangers into our lives the way we do. And I say we because I've worked in Europe and in Asia and in Africa and in North America. And I think that's space enough, geography enough for me to conclude that if I'm allowed in a boat in West Africa and I'm allowed into a refugee tent in the Caucasus, and I'm allowed into a flooded home in New Orleans, that means all of us carry this welcoming ability to let someone who's very different from us into our space and into our life, which I think is, you know, beautiful and hopeful. In practical terms, I walked up to a bunch of fishermen and said, "Hi, I'm a weird white woman who wants to know how to learn to fish, and I'm a writer." And everybody laughed, and eventually one of them said, "Well, tomorrow 6:30 in the morning, be here."
How did you communicate? Were you speaking French? How did you speak to them?
I work with a translator, and I speak very bad French, which I call pêcheurs, which is, you know, fisherman's French, which is because I learned it from fishermen in Senegal. And I spoke a modicum of Wolof by the time I was finished with my life in Joal. And Wolof is the language that most Joalian fishermen speak.
In the previous book, in the Fulani book, your translators are very present. I don't remember you even mentioning one in this book.
Because we didn't work very closely together.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about these fishermen. These are amazing people and the boats. Let's talk about the boats and the people that make them and that go out into the middle of the ocean. This is incredible. It was stunning to discover what they actually do.
The boats are made keel first. They're plank boats, carvel built on a keel that's made out of a hollowed tree trunk, which is, if you will, a proto-pirogue. First men went to sea in hollowed out tree trunks. And that keel is usually made out of Senegalese mahogany, which is a very expensive and a rapidly decimated resource that grows in southern Senegal. In some boats, the larger boats can be as long as 150 feet long, which is pretty massive for a boat that doesn't have a below deck, for example. So it just, and no deck, it just, you know, a simple needle-shaped boat that is enormous. And the smallest boat I fished on, that was, you know, a trapper, so it goes out for, it sets traps for cuttlefish and murex and cymbian, which are two mollusks that are popular catches in Senegal. These boats can be, you know, 12 feet long and 2 feet across, so very narrow and very long, small boats made out of a lighter wood called abache, which is what you normally use to make the backs of your cabinet drawers. So very light wood. Doesn't last very long in the water, but a cheap boat to make.
And these fishermen, most of them are believers in Islam. Is that right?
Most fishermen I've worked with are Muslim, yes.
Okay, and are they Sufis?
Sufi Muslims, yes.
Uh-huh. And so in this particular community, a man could have up to four wives. And you take us into this culture, and there, at one point you explain, someone told you, okay, the first wife will be this, the second wife will be that. You know, one is for the heart, one is for the looks. Can you explain all that? This is just intriguing to someone from my culture.
So Senegal allows men to have up to four wives, and polygamy is very widespread. And they say, as you said, the first wife is usually an arranged. The first marriage is usually arranged. And my friend Nongo Suare, who's a captain of one of my captains with whom I worked, who's a little younger than me, he's probably 40 now, and he has three wives. And what happened was he was 18 years old, and his uncle came from Dakar to Joal and brought a bag of kola nut, which is a traditional ceremonial offering. You bring it to weddings, you bring it to funerals, you give it to elders as a sign of respect. So he brought a bag of kola nut to Ndongo's dad, and his dad said, "What's this?" And the uncle said, "That's my daughter and your son getting married. Have a kola nut." So basically, even without his father's knowledge, his relatives decided that it was time for Ndongo to get married, lest he should impregnate a girl, you know, who's not his wife. So his first wife is an arranged marriage. They married when they were 18 years old. And then the second wife is usually a choice of the heart, they say in Senegal. So it's, you know, you fall in love eventually and marry that woman, if she agrees and stars align. And then they say the third wife is a trophy wife, the beautiful wife. And they say the fourth wife is a child you take in marriage when you're older so that she take care of you when you're infirm. You know, essentially you're marrying a sitter, if you will. What I can't understand is where so many women come from, because Senegal has slightly more women than men, but we're talking, you know, 10% more women than men, not four times more women than men. So I haven't figured out how that math works.
Huh. One of the great dramas you describe in Fisherman's Blues is this fellow, this fisherman who is trying to rebuild his boat, and it's costing him a lot of money that he doesn't have, and they are so dependent upon catching fish to get income, and if you can't fish, you can't get income, and you can't rebuild your boat. And I think it's his third wife who has a child at this time, which is going to cause a lot more debt, because they have to have a celebration and a ceremony for this third child. And you describe the ceremony, and they're dancing, and the wives come out in numerical order. This is absolutely intriguing.
Yeah, the dance, the master of ceremonies, a griot, who's hired for the event, he calls out first, you know, dance of the first wife, and then there's a little song he sings to honor the first wives, and then all the women who are present who happen to be first wives, and then he sings another song of the second wife for the second wives to dance to, and we stopped at the third wife because it was the ceremony that was celebrating the birth by Ndongo's third wife. It's interesting, you know. I've seen very content polygamist marriages, and I've seen extremely miserable polygamist marriages. But I've also seen very content monogamous marriages and very miserable monogamous marriages, you know, in the world. So I can't, as a divorced woman who's not married, I can't tell you what works.
Right.
I don't feel that I have the agency to pass judgment.
Anna Bodkin joins me. Her new book is Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. And I'd like our listeners to know that you weren't just riding along in these boats with your notebook and drawing pictures and writing notes and just kind of sitting there as an observer. You were actually fishing. You were working, helping them make the boats. You were very much involved with them. And at one point, you're on the beach and you see a young man, and you, I think you've just come back from a fishing trip, and he asks you if you were fishing. He seems very surprised. And then he asks you if you were getting paid. You were, weren't you?
Well, I was not. I always refused my share. But
okay.
I was working as a deckie, which is it's the lowest rung of, you know, manual labor on a boat. It's because I'm not skilled at fishing, and I also am not strong enough to do what is extremely heavy work, especially on the big purse netter boats. But the way fishing works in Senegal is everybody who works on a boat gets the same share of the catch. So you fish, you come back to port, you sell the catch, and then what's left is divided equally between the crew, and then there's a share that goes to the motor, which means fuel for the next trip, and then there's a share that goes for the boat, which means repair work that's necessary to, you know, to perform on the boat. And that usually is a savings, right, in case something goes wrong. But there are a lot of very young people who work on boats, you know, children of fishing captains or children of other fishermen. I've worked with crews where, you know, there were 9-year-olds and 10-year-olds on board, and a 9-year-old will get the same share as the captain, which I think is tremendous.
Mm-hmm. And these young boys, quite often their job, when they've set the nets and they're trying to drive the fish into the nets, they jump in the water and try to drive the fish literally by swimming at them.
Scaring the fish, yeah. They make a lot of noise splashing the water, trying to drive the fish into the net. When you fish with a gill net, which is, by the way, illegal in many countries in the world because the bycatch is so vast, and the only way to extricate the bycatch or any catch from that net is by ripping it out, which usually kills whatever is in the net. Mm-hmm. Gill net catches fish by the gills. So it, literally, fish gets stuck, head gets stuck in the net. And so when you're hunting for fish, when you're fishing with a gill net, you orient the fish so it runs into the net. And that's why people would make tremendous racket by jumping overboard and splashing and also banging on the boat with boards, basically disorienting the fish. The fish is pretty sensitive to vibrations, so disorienting the fish into ramming headfirst into the net.
Anna Bodkin joins us, returning to the program with her book Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. As you observe in these books, I really appreciate the fact that you are just observing and you don't render judgments. You observe the pollution and the things that people do that maybe the reader would say, that's terrible. But you don't make judgments, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
In this book, this new book, they did something, and I'm not going to say what it is, but they did something that really threw you for a loop because suddenly you were no longer the observer. You were part of the story. Wow, I love that. What a wonderful thing for them to do, but I can see how you were a little bit shocked.
Yeah, when I shared with my friends in the States and my editor, actually, for the book, when I wrote a note saying, this is what happened, and they said, that's amazing. That's great. And I was not feeling great at all. Mm-hmm. I felt that I was dragged. You know, I was caught in the net and dragged into the story that I was trying to learn. But you know what? We're talking about boundaries, right? And I have a boundary that I like to have, a boundary between me and the story. That is a very convenient and a very unrealistic boundary, because when you commit to a community, that boundary has to be rethought. Mm-hmm. When you become part of the community, when you engage in a community, you have to stop distancing yourself, and in a way, that gift that we won't tell our listeners about, mm-hmm. Hoping that they will find out from the book. In a way, it was my friends telling me, "Here, you're here. Don't pretend that you're elsewhere. Stop creating this artificial distance between you and us. You know, you work with us on a boat. You help us make lunch. You help us look after our kids. You're here. Don't be distant. That boundary is fake." And that's, you know, it's very humbling, and also it really in a way is comforting.
Mm. You are not invisible, even though sometimes they would have conversations out there on the boat where they acted like you weren't even there. And I'm really wanting to talk a little bit about the role of women in this society. You observe that very closely. Tell us how women were treated and what their roles were.
So the Wolof have a creation story. And in the creation story, the king, the first king of the Jolof, king of the Wolof, his name was Njajanja, and he was sort of like a cross between Perseus and Hamlet. His father was an Almoravid sheikh. We're talking about 11th century. His father was a sheikh. His mother was a princess. His father died, and he, before his death, he asked his wife, his future widow, to marry the most pious Muslim she knew. And so after his death, after his father's death, the mother of Jajan Jai married their servant. And Jajan Jai was indignant at his mother's remarriage. So in protest, he threw himself into the river, the Senegal River, and remained stubbornly afloat for 7 years until he passed a group of arguing children who were arguing about their catch, fishing children. And he, you know, once a prince, always a prince, he passed his judgment, and the children liked how he solved their issue, and the children went to the villagers and told them about this man who's floating in the river and is so wise. So the fishermen decided, so the villagers decided to fish him out of the river and make him their king, but he didn't want to get settled. So he pretended to be mute until a woman came out and started to pretend to cook in a pot that she was trying to set on two stones. And the kettle kept falling into the fire because it's really hard to use two stones as a bipod. You need a tripod. So after a while, Jajan Jai got so impatient that he said, "Well, I, a woman, use three stones." And realizing he had spoken, conceded that he will become the ruler. You know, when I heard this story, I thought, and here we are, women hoodwink men into settling down. Men give advice unbidden. And even when they have settled down, they're never really home. So, you know, with fishing husbands and sons and fathers, what happens is the seaside is populated by women, and women run everything. They run homes, they run businesses. Most businesses around fish, like fish processing businesses, restaurant businesses, are run by women. And men go out to sea and come back with fish, or, as happens more and more often, they go out to sea and come back without fish.
Mm. Well, Anna, I want to thank you for writing another exquisitely beautiful, deeply informative book. It's just wonderful how you write. It's such great literature. I really appreciate the way you write.
Oh, thank you for such kind words. They really mean a lot to me. Thank you.
Is the next project out there? Do you have any sense of what that might be?
Yes, the next project is a novel, and it's set on the border of the United States and Mexico, and it's a novel about homelessness and identity and genocide. So we'll see what happens. It's my first novel. I've never written long fiction before.
Wow. Well, I will look forward to that if you ever finish it.
Oh, don't be so hopeless.
I'm just teasing you, Anna. Well, it's really been great to reconnect with you again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure talking to you always. Thank you.
The book is Fisherman's Blues, A West African Community at Sea. My guest has been Anna Bodkin. You've been listening to The Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McCulis.